This is the Media Freak Podcast. It's the latest and greatest podcast created by media people who are just a little bit freaky. We're not the big dogs, we're the ones in the media trenches who tell you how it really is. Each episode, you'll hear from us with a round of media news, our expert guests, and some anonymous sources about the freaky world of media. So who's on the mic? It's me, your host, Harriet from Smartly, Bookie from Coffee Cup.
Yo, yo, yo.
And Charlie from Show Heroes.
Hello.
How are you doing, gang?
Good. Very good.
Not bad. It's post-birthday week. I'm chilling, having a good time.
You're missing Jack, though, aren't we?
We are. Father Jack. Are you another year older and another year wiser, Bookie?
I would say maybe one of those things.
I think wiser. You're going to bring all the knowledge today, aren't you?
I'm definitely going to bring some thoughts and feelings, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, we look forward to those. In today's episode, we discuss the latest shakeup in retail media, agency holdco updates, and chat more on the context behind the growing trend of companies returning to private ownership. So, let's get into it. In the retail media landscape, retail media is one of the fastest growing areas of the industry. Put simply, it's a form of advertising where retailers use their own channels, like e-commerce sites, apps, and so on, to target consumers based on purchase data and behaviour. Now, we're starting to see many different players immerse themselves in the commerce and retail media space, including the financial sector. So in October, MasterCard announced the launch of a new commerce media network. Have you heard about this?
Yeah,
definitely saw that, yeah.
Very good. Well, MasterCard Commerce Media has been positioned as a digital network that will provide advertisers with insights and enhanced ROAS by enabling brands to target consumers based on purchase behaviour across various e-commerce sites and in-store environments. But believe it or not, they're not actually the only ones doing this. So do you know who else has done this recently?
Yes, well, we've got Amex have started their Amex ads, but I think actually before then was Chase over in the US, right?
Yeah, correct. So for Amex ads, it's being launched in the US, and of course they'll leverage their first-party data to offer contextual targeting and measurement tools. So there's lots going on in the financial sector. And my question for you is, from a consumer perspective, do you think these moves will, I guess, influence consumer experiences and perceptions of those brands?
Yeah, I think, well, again, we're sort of already in the midst of it. PayPal actually was the other one that I forgot to mention there. But in terms of the experiences and perceptions, it kind of really depends on what the execution's like, right? I mean, it makes sense that this is the road we're going down with sort of the commerce media section of retail media. MasterCard themselves have got like 500 million enrolled customers and 160 billion transactions done last year. So there's a massive, massive pool of data that they can use to really and directly attribute spend. MasterCard can put an ad in there or their partner's environment, and then when someone spends on that, we have then direct sales attribution, which is very attractive to the sort of CFO of a company, where they can see directly exactly where their spend, or the ROAS, as we say, has been effective. There is a bit of an argument that we're sort of further losing the battle of the CMO versus the CFO. In the brand building versus the lower funnel immediate, this is where my money's gone effects. But yeah, going back to the consumer for a second, I suppose the it depends how creepy it is, because you can imagine a world where,
yep,
I don't know, someone doesn't buy Tampax for 2 months and now you get an ad for baby formula. Like, it could get to that depth of it. And yeah, the personalization, how it affects us on a day-to-day will be interesting to see who sort of scrapes the bottom of the barrel first.
Yeah, I actually couldn't agree more. I think from a consumer's point of view, I actually think the base level is like no one's going to notice. I think they're just going to assume, like, we already sit here and say, oh, my phone's listening, my phone's listening, my phone's listening. We already think things are listening to us. So I don't think anyone's going to notice. But to your point, if they do notice, there might be a worse perception, because then they're like, to your point, how did you know I stopped buying tampons? Mm. And now you're giving me baby formula and, I don't know, pregnancy tests. Leave me alone. So I think that's going to be the interesting part from the consumer point of view. From the industry point of view, I think it is smart for these companies to do this. I think as advertisers, we already know that the pool of data that we have to target is getting squeezed at every angle. So from their point of view, they're like, rah, we already have so much data. Why don't we monetize it even better? And then people like us and advertisers and brand marketers are going to be actually beholden to their rules. We're going to have to target on what they give us, because we haven't really got anything else to target on. So I think we've kind of made a bit of a rod for our own backs in the way that we went so down the personalization route. But as a result, it just kind of means that we need data in order to keep that model going. So yeah, I think it'll be a really, really interesting way, interesting one for us to do.
So from a consumer perspective, you think that trust is going to be the factor that's influenced the most. And then from an industry perspective, you think that it will essentially reshape the competitive landscape?
I don't think it's going to reshape the competitive landscape. I think it's just going to bring us closer to where we were trying to go. As in, when I say we, I mean more digital advertising. We always wanted to do this, but when we started having, you know, when GDPR and all that kind of came in, and when the end of cookies started to come in, we got pushed back into just do contextual, because that's the only targeting thing we've got. You know, you go onto Meta and some of the ways you target don't even exist anymore on there. We're not able to use those data points. So this just brings data back into our pools for us to target again. So I think it will be a deepening of where we initially wanted to go. But who knows how long for.
I guess it changes the landscape insofar as the players are changing. But we do have to wonder, you mentioned GDPR and cookies, like, there's a reason why we had to move away from them. Do we not just feel like we're just getting on another merry-go-round and we are okay, MasterCard and PayPal and potentially Visa, when they decide inevitably to go down there? Do we then just find ourselves where, okay, now we have to regulate again because we've gone too far down that road? Is it just
Charlie,
make as much money while you can and move on?
Is 2.0 in. He's 2.0 in. Because, correct, that is exactly what I think anyway. That's exactly where I think we're going. I think we are going to see what's next after this. But I do want to shout out really quickly, man like Visa. So Visa, straight up, and obviously we don't know if this is going to change in the future, depending on how this goes, but Visa will never, and they've said before that they would never work in this way. They never kind of monetize their transactions. And I've always kind of really admired, when I found that out, I was like, that's really, really, there's a lot of integrity, I think, in that. So love that.
They could shape their whole marketing strategy on that as well. Like, that's a really nice point of differentiator. So.
Yeah, and it's addressing the issue of trust, isn't it?
Mm. It is.
But yeah, I don't know. I think it will naturally reshape the competitive landscape if you've got all these new players holding that level of data. But only time will tell. So, yeah. Well, anyway, moving on. In network agency news, so WPP is continuing to enhance its capabilities with AI. The industry press have reported on their latest big deal with Google, which is a $400 million agreement to integrate Google's various AI tools, including Gemini and so on. But what does this actually mean? Well, it means that WPP will use Google's tech stack to analyze data, optimize media buying, and so on. And WPP's clients can still use other tech stacks. However, that may present some operational complexities, of course. But by doing what they're doing, WPP will stay competitive within the HoldCo space, especially as agencies are relying more heavily on AI and automation. But my question for you is, whilst this may seem like a step in the right direction, WPP's well-documented challenges go well beyond kind of technology. I mean, they include client retention, revenue growth, and investor confidence, all of which we've discussed in former podcasts. AI alone won't really fix those problems. So is there another strategy behind this deal?
Bookie.
So obviously I think at length about WPP.
I bet you do. It's like an ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, the one who got away. But the more and more I've thought about this, like, I think my feelings have really changed and developed in terms of what I think is kind of going on there. I think that the moment WPP made access to high quality inventory, but at the cheapest rate, when they started doing the prop media stuff with the implementation of Zaxis. So this is what, like 2011 times? I can't remember when Zaxis started, but at that point, when they made that their USP versus people like Publicis, I think they inadvertently made platforms their competitor rather than the other holdcos. And so we're now in a point where the way they're doing this and what they're kind of, and I think also we didn't really mention in here, but the release of, they've basically used the open platform and they're letting smaller companies kind of use that to make their own ads and stuff. Mm. So basically what we said a couple of podcasts ago, that we think WPP might be moving towards a self-serve platform.
Well, you said, Bookie, you can take the credit on predicting the future there.
Thank you very much. I said they're going to go to a self-serve platform. I think that's exactly what's going on. So you start plugging in things like Google and all these AI things, and actually, I don't think we're all looking at the demise of WPP. I feel like actually WPP is playing a different game now. It's not playing versus Publicis and them man anymore. It's playing versus the platforms, because when you had like Meta, WPP can't compete with Meta prices direct. It can't compete with TikTok prices. It can't compete with any of the platforms prices direct. What are you going to do? You're going to integrate them. And I think it's been making some really strategic partnerships across the platforms. And then you think about what they're doing, with their strategy of people. You know, we're stripping out the people. We're getting back to churning it out. They're competing on a different thing. So what I was thinking about today when I was just doing my final kind of bits of research was, what happens if there's a world where Publicis, for example, becomes the creative agency across the board? It holds global narratives and global strategies with global clients. But then you see the local markets, maybe who have in-housed their media, because we're seeing that growing trend. They start plugging in to WPP Open self-serve and buying their media based on the work that publicists are doing. Who's actually winning? Because we've always said all the money's with media and not the creative. Maybe they are literally just playing the game. They're not being sexy. They're being absolutely necessary. And I don't know. I think like they're just the first ones to go.
They're
the first ones to make a move. WPP are the first ones to make a move, because we've also been talking about how, the industry is at a crossroads. It's a paradigm shift going on. The old HoldCo model is not fit for purpose. Meanwhile, no one's really changing the model. The only people changing the model is WPP. Publicis is just doing the current model very well and mopping up everyone who wants that model for now. But I think there's going to be a very big space and a very big gap potentially opening up for people who want access to what WPP can do. So as much as I, at the beginning, was like, what the hell's going on? I think I'm starting to see the vision.
and do you see the vision, Charlie? What do you think is the real reason behind this deal?
I mean, I clearly don't have the foresight that Mystic Bookie does. But I mean, look, they needed to do something on a very basic level. They needed to do something because, Habas have got their $400 million converged AI program. Omnicom made Microsoft / OpenAI, of course, the engine for OmniAssist. publicist launched Marcel back in like 2018 or 2019 or something like that, which is similar to the open thingy. And Dentsu have got, they've sort of expanded the partnership with Vertex AI. So in a world of AI and AI dominating discourse in every way, shape or form, from creative to efficiency to jobs to just about any topic we can think of, it's unsurprising that they came with a sort of AI across everything, is that the tagline that they used? But again, it's on the surface, you know, they're clearly losing the battle and the war when it comes to the holdcos, and publicists in this instance are winning and spending $400 million on sort of integrating AI into everything, which could mean anything. It's not the AI integration that caused publicists to win. It's investing in Epsilon and Sapient and recently into Lotame. So we'll see. I really like the idea of Bookie's thoughts, and you never know, maybe that crystal ball turns out to be a good one.
Yeah,
I just, if it does, people need to start basing their lottery numbers on me.
their media lottery. Yeah, maybe we replace Media Anon with Mystic Bookie. Time with Mystic Bookie and the crystal ball. But no, I mean, you know, we've got a lot of you know, broad ideas as to what and why, but I mean, it could just be to make sure that they've got Google as a customer for longer, right?
Well, it's a good point. I mean, is there a conflict of interest there? Google are basically the biggest sort of, you know, company in the media advertising space, is getting them closer into the depths of their business the right move, or is it going to open them up to some scrutiny? It's clearly a great deal for Google because they get a load of money, they get a load of exposure with very little risk. They can then test new products with WPP, and you know, they can provide their tech expertise, aka tell them what to do. So yeah, great deal to Google for sure.
Cool. And like, when you think about it, obviously they're working very closely with Amazon, working very closely with Google. I think, you know, TikTok partnership was announced not so long ago. They are really bringing in the biggest platforms to make sure they stay alongside. So I really do think that, you know, in this short term, tough times, but midterm,
Cindy Babes is doing what she needs to do.
Cindy Babes is coming correct. Cindy Babes, I knew a woman would sort it all out. I knew she'd sort it all out.
Adjacently, Harry, did you mention that they're still free to use other platforms?
Yeah, clients can use other
clients can
stacks.
Use other platforms. Because I was just thinking, like, there's a good chance that sort of Google don't win this AI war. Right. And if they locked into, is it a 4 or 5 year contract? Like, AI is like, tech moves fast, AI moves faster. And there's a very good chance that some things happen outside of Google's capabilities that other companies could be first to, and WPP don't get the chance to jump because they've locked into quite a long deal in a fast paced area. So we'll see.
It's kind of giving slow and steady wins a race, though. You know what I mean? I feel like when you're talking about companies like Google ain't about to fail just yet. So even if they're not the first ones there, they will either copy the hell out of someone and scale it faster than anyone ever could, or just, you know, make their own. So I think it's a good point. It is a very, very good point. But I think when you're partnering with Google and them, man, you got a good chance.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, anyway, in other agency news, it's all doom and gloom, according to global research and advisory firm Forrester. Have I pronounced that right correctly, Charlie? Because usually you pick me up on these things.
I believe
that felt
so,
right.
But
okay. Right.
I don't know how you do that one wrong, but you never know.
Well, you never know. I've been there before. So their 2026 marketing agency predictions suggest that 15% of jobs will be lost in 2026 as a result of the disruption taking place and traditional agency models weakening. Now, like I said, this is all doom and gloom, so I don't want to put this into our listeners' heads, given that I'm sure we have a lot of agency listeners, of course. So rather than think of the negatives on this, I want to ask you about what new opportunities could emerge for agencies and obviously talent of agencies to adapt and potentially reskill in the new year.
I think that there's a reason why a lot of these jobs are being lost. Consolidation is one thing. I mean, we've got the Omnicom IPG merger. That's probably going to have an effect. The dirty words of AI are always going to come into the effect here. You've also just got macroeconomic challenges. So I don't think you can really handle the macroeconomic side with mergers. It's tough to predict who and how people are going to be affected by that. So I'll focus on the one we can do, and that's obviously the AI side of things. But things will change quickly, as we've said. But with any new technology, there's always a raft of opportunities that come out of adjacent industries and new ways to be able to add value to your current company. So to put it sort of bluntly, is like stay up to date, keep across like what the opportunities are, where your company is investing, grow your network as well. So make sure you're talking to enough people. And don't be afraid to take a risk as well. Like, depends on where you are in your career. But if you see an emerging company or an emerging part of the industry that you think is going to be interesting, then don't be afraid to take a bit of a risk on it.
So, Pukki, how might these changes encourage career mobility or potentially more creative or strategic roles in the industry?
I mean, it's a tough one because...
You're working for a creative production house, Pukki.
And the questions are there. Like, I think there is a lot of... There's a lot of fear and there's a lot of concern of how we do that. But essentially, it's all about what kind of Charlie said. It's working out how AI works with you rather than how AI replaces you. Mm. You need to adapt. The first and the best to adapt will be the one to kind of stay relevant. But, you know, instead of thinking, oh, we'll get AI to make this creative, think about how you can use it to do all the boring bits. You know, if your creative process involves you having to put things on like a wireframe, but every time you want to make a change, you need to make a new wireframe, how can you get AI to do all of that wireframing so that you don't have to spend hours and hours just because you want to make a small tweak? That's how you want to start using AIs. But that's kind of what I was just thinking. What Charlie said was fairly adequate.
Fairly adequate. That's the level of advice we give these days. Fairly adequate. No, come to the Media Freak podcast for fairly adequate advice.
It was very adequate. Just stay up to date and just make sure you know how to incorporate into your current role before someone replaces your entire role with it. Because it won't do as good of a job as you are doing, but it will do it quicker. And you know that triangle where you've got like, you know, speed, quality and cost. Yeah. Like, some people will prefer the speed and the cost being lower than the quality. And so in those spaces, yeah, jobs might go. But in other cases where you've got, people wanting decent work and decent people, just make sure you integrate it so you can maybe bring down the speed. So at least you've got quality and speed on your side, if not for
I think one interesting bit to see will be, I think the sort of the creative side of our industry and all industries is probably more under threat given generative AI. But a good idea is a good idea. And despite having all the tools at your fingers, you still need a good idea to be able to execute. So we're moving the power away from traditional video and graphic designers and putting more power into essentially what are prompt engineers, in a similar way to how computer programming is going through a similar change at the moment. So learning how to, or not learning, but having the creative power between you and a team is more important than being able to have the world at your fingertips in terms of like, I can generate a dancing banana great. It's the ideas that are the really important bit that are going to cut through, that are going to have a sort of a social effect, are going to be able to keep up with the zeitgeist of the world and create really impactful campaigns. So ideas over sort of a multitude of random videos that you could end up with, perhaps what Meta are doing with their pushing people towards their video generation stuff. But we'll talk about that another time, I'm sure.
Yeah, so we're saying that, essentially saying that, yes, even though AI is taking jobs, there's still a clear need for a human touch, especially when it comes to kind of the big ideas and the strategic approaches to those things.
And as much as it's taking jobs, it's creating them. Like there are
changing jobs is the way to put it.
There are roles and there are needs that didn't exist before because we weren't dealing with AI. And so whilst I myself am a bit, you know, I don't love generative AI, I think AI for efficiencies is fantastic. Generative AI is not necessarily something that I'm a big fan of. And so, I think it will just steer people in terms of where they want to go to. So, yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I think as an analogy, when we moved from horses and boats into trains, the canal builders turned into the railway builders. But we needed new engineers. So there some jobs change, some jobs just get created.
Yeah, you still need people steering the ships, don't you? And a lot of agency skills are naturally transferable in a tech environment. If I do say so myself.
Case in point, yeah.
Anyway, well, on another note, we'd like to talk to you about Alchemy Network. Alchemy Network is a unique innovation consultancy that's helping companies gain competitive advantage through marketing and advertising technology. They work with thousands of brands and agencies globally and identify needs and interests that save agency folk time and effort by curating the landscape. They can be used if you have a simple brief in mind or simply as a form of learning and development. Email hello@alchemy-network.co.uk to find out more. Now, on to our main topic, the great delisting. What does going private mean for marketing? There's a growing trend of big named companies returning to private ownership. There's The Body Shop, Superdry, Boots, and more brands are stepping away from public markets. Even EA is exploring a similar move, which signals a potential shift in how brands want to operate and grow. So what's driving this? It could be shareholder pressure. It could be restructuring quietly in a tougher economy. But what does this actually mean for marketing strategies and ad budgets moving forward? Is this the return to long-term brand building over quarterly performance campaigns? We obviously had Bea, our guest, in a couple of weeks ago that talked about, or she talked a lot about, the importance of brand building against performance. But Buki, I know you were quite interested in this topic generally. So what are your thoughts? Well, agencies face new dynamics as clients move away from public to private?
You know, I love stuff like this, to be fair. I think it's really interesting, especially when we have it in conjunction with the conversation we're having around, you know, WPP and moving towards that kind of more automated self-serve, just access to inventory and access to kind of creative. I think that this trend is one that kind of reflects a bigger kind of shift in, but without getting too far into it, where the state of capitalism, to be perfectly honest. I think where we have got into a space where before, for any business, your goal was set up your business, grow it, go public, get loads of money in, loads of funding, and then you just grow exponentially. But we've got to a point where we're realizing not every business can do that. Yeah, we have some huge corporations that can do that, you know, especially when I look at the likes of someone like a L'Oreal who have grown to such heights. And then just when you think they might be stagnating, they hit you with some really cool stuff and they grow again. So from my point of view, I think that is still possible for some companies. But I think where their success has now kind of informed other people, they're trying to emulate that and it's not possible because the shareholders come in and then they take what was helping that company grow, squeeze the life out of it, and then get confused when the revenues don't match what they were having before. You know, I think it's Lululemon. That's Coco Melon. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting case right now of a company that was doing so well and I believe went public, and now like their like share price is tanking because they haven't had the creative freedom, and they've replaced their marketers with procurement people and finance people, and they are probably trying to do the things that WPP want to do, but they're not the kind of brand that can do it. You know, a L'Oreal would be able to do something like that because they have so many products and so many things, and they're also investing at that brand level, but they're going to need to churn out the stuff to keep themselves front of mind. So I think, what does it signify for marketing strategies? I think in that kind of midsection of companies, I definitely think we're going back to a lot of the brand building. These things happening in cycles anyway. Content was king, and then personalization was king, and now content's going to be king once again. But at the same time, you know, personalization will be queen. So I think there's going to be an increased use of both sections, but I think in the middle, brand building's on the up because they need to fight.
I don't know if Charlie's doing like a secret celebratory dance there to your feedback. He's like, yeah, just bopping around. It's
my dog is attacking me from the light. She okay, wants to go for a walk, so yeah.
Okay, so no thoughts from you, Charlie, on that point.
I think that was covered beautifully. It's but yeah, I can only echo your points, Bookie, about hopefully we can go back to remove the sort of pressures of having to have quarterly growth and products being squeezed. I mean, Lululemon, I know, had issues with like their product quality. I can only imagine that's as a result of sort of declining standards. So yeah, let's give more power back to the brands themselves and not to the boys in the boardroom with the spreadsheets.
I love that, Charlie. Yeah.
Let's hope Lululemon gets the melons.
God's sakes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, well, that wraps up this week. You can respond and have your say in any of the topics and stories we discuss on the podcast. It's email us at info.tmfpod@gmail.com. I don't know why I said it's email us. You could just email us. It's me. Email us. And thank you for listening to the Media Freak podcast. If you like listening to our freak this week, remember to like, subscribe, and tell all your friends.